The scripture reading for this morning will be from Acts chapter 16, verses 16 through 24. As we were going to the place of prayer, we were met by a slave girl who had a spirit of divination and brought her owners much gain by fortune-telling. She followed Paul and us, crying out, "These men are servants of the Most High God, who proclaim to you the way of salvation." And this she kept doing for many days. Paul, having become greatly annoyed, turned and said to the spirit, "I command you in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her." And it came out that very hour. But when her owners saw that their hope of gain was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace before the rulers. And when they had brought them to the magistrates, they said, "These men are Jews, and they are disturbing our city. They advocate customs that are not lawful for us as Romans to accept or practice." The crowds joined in attacking them, and the magistrates tore the garments off them and gave orders to beat them with rods. And when they had inflicted many blows upon them, they threw them into the prison, ordering the jailer to keep them safely. Having received this order, he put them into the inner prison and fastened their feet in the stocks.
Good morning. Continuing today our series out of the book of Acts and the why of Christianity, and we're looking at what is it that makes sense of Christianity, how is it that it happens the way that it does, and what does that mean for us today. Today our question is, why succeed? And maybe not the greatest title I've ever come up with, but what I'm trying to ask is, why is it that Christianity works, and why is it that Christianity worked? Why does Christianity happen? Not every day do you start a global religion. Not every day does a couple of fellows get together and say, "I've got a great idea," and then everyone just agrees with that idea and runs with it. Not every day do people convert and change their entire manner of life, their convictions, their worldview to something new in mass numbers. And yet that's the kind of thing we're seeing on a regular basis in the book of Acts. Today, I think we have a temptation to say, yes, well, it was easier back then. Those apostles preaching the New Testament, people were different then. You know, they were more open to religious ideas. And today, we have so many obstacles that make it difficult for Christianity to thrive and be a success in our culture. And I think if we think that, we are a little bit naive and maybe a fair bit ignorant of how much opposition Christianity had right at the beginning of its inception. Christianity did not survive and thrive because it was unopposed. Christianity did not survive and thrive because things were easy. In fact, it was in spite of that. And the story we looked at this morning here in just a moment in Acts, the 16th chapter, we're going to see an example of a conversion story, of a couple of conversion stories. But what's fascinating about it is that it happens all over the Roman Empire throughout the book of Acts. Rodney Stark wrote a book he's a sociologist, a historian, not writing necessarily from a New Testament perspective, but just from the point of history. He says, looking at the numbers of the growth of Christianity, it's hard to express to people how quickly and how massively that religion grew. If you imagine in the year 40 AD, you've got about 1,000 Christians. That's a low estimate, by the way. He's trying to be conservative. In the book of Acts, they start out with about 3,000. But in any event, he's kind of rounding down and saying, if you just start out with about 1,000 of them at the end of the first decade of Christianity, remember we started out with 12, he says, historically, we can say there were at least 7,500 of them by the end of the first century. I also think that's a low number. But then by the year 200, there's something like 218,000 Christians in the Roman Empire. Still a minority, still only about a third of the percent of the population at that time. By 300 AD, it's something like 10%. And then by 350 AD, it's something like 56.5%, or the majority of the Roman Empire, is professing some kind of Christianity. That is a phenomenal story of growth, even over three centuries. You say, well, it took 300 years. Well, you try it, right? You try to get half of the population of anything to grow and to accept a particular point of view in any amount of time. It's an incredible story of success. Origen, the Christian writer from 248 AD, said, "Let it be granted that Christians were few in the beginning." We didn't start out with a massive empire that then just kind of rolled out and took over. This was, as the story goes, 12 people preaching the gospel, and then a few hundred people, and then a few thousand people, and on it goes. Everywhere they go, they face opposition, and yet everywhere they go, they have some measure of success. How does this happen? And then more importantly for us, how could that happen today? Because we'd like to see that, wouldn't we? We would like to see people in grand numbers taking on Christ as their identity and following and believing Him. What is it that made this possible? And again, let me reiterate, it wasn't a lack of opposition. Turn, if you would, now to our text in Acts, the 16th chapter. And just read with me the short part of this. We'll go further into the chapter in a moment. But just read the opposition section from verses 16 through 24, which is our scripture reading this morning. As we were going to the place of prayer, we were met by a slave girl who had a spirit of divination and brought her owners much gain by fortune-telling. She followed Paul and us, crying out, "These men are servants of the Most High God who proclaim to you the way of salvation." And this she kept doing for many days. Paul, having become greatly annoyed, turned and said to the spirit, "I command you in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her." And it came out of her that very hour. But when her owners saw their hope of gain was gone, they seized Paul and Silas and dragged them into the marketplace before the rulers. And when they had brought them to the magistrates, they said, "These men are Jews, and they are disturbing our city. They advocate customs that are not lawful for us as Romans to accept or practice." And the crowd joined in attacking them, and the magistrates tore the garments off them and gave orders to beat them with rods. And when they had inflicted many blows upon them, they threw them into prison, ordering the jailer to keep them safely. Having received this order, he put them into the inner prison and fastened their feet in the stocks. Does this sound unopposed to you? Does it sound like a cakewalk to you? Of course not. Think about just a moment the different obstacles that early Christianity had as represented just in this story. First of all, people already had a religion they were pretty happy with. When you look at this story, it doesn't call it by name, but there was a Roman culture already at work that was, in its own way, deeply religious. And the first accusation against the Christians is, first of all, that they're Jews, right? So the Romans are already biased about that. They say, well, these are Jews. And they're teaching customs that don't get along with our customs. We have a way of doing things. We have Roman gods, we have rules, we have ways of living and worshiping and being devout. We have a piety all our own, and that's not what these fellows are preaching. They're causing trouble. And so there's already a religion in place. They aren't going into a vacuum where nothing exists and people are asking, boy, I wish we had a religion. These are people that already have ideas about the world. So much so that we have a woman who is a fortune teller, who has a spirit of some kind, and people are kind of used to that. That's part of their world. That's what's going on there in that story. There are powerful people who oppose Christianity. In fact, throughout the book of Acts, one of the themes is that powerful people always oppose Christianity. Powerless people become Christians. If you were in Acts, the 13th chapter in Bible class this morning, we got a piece of that, where it is the leading women and men of Judaism in the city that cause problems for the Roman teacher, or for the Christian teachers in that city, whereas there are some down in kind of the dregs of society who are actually hearing the gospel and saying, yeah, that sounds pretty good to us. But the powerful people are the ones being first and foremost rebuked for their sins, and they don't like it. And so everywhere Christians go, in every city they enter, find the most powerful people in that town, and you can almost guarantee it, that they are in opposition to Christians. In this case, it's magistrates and leaders of the people in that way. Governments, which makes the second point, the government itself is systematically opposed to Christianity. No matter how bad your idea is, in America, we'll let you have it. Right? That's one of our ground rules. We try really hard, and some days we're better at it than others. But in America, if you want to start a really foolish religion, we are, on a systematic level, okay with that. And we won't stop you. We'll treat you like other religions in that sense. That's one of our founding principles that, we do better at sometimes than others. The Roman Empire is not like that. The Roman Empire, like all ancient governments, religion and devotion are married to the government. To oppose the religion of Rome is to oppose the government of Rome, and they notice. Their job is to keep the peace and keep tax dollars flowing through an orderly society to Rome, and these Christians are upsetting things. The government sees them as a threat and starts to deal with them. We have a mob of common folk, right? Just in case we weren't sure, I said, you know, maybe the poor and impoverished favor Christianity. In this case, actually, nobody likes Christianity. In this particular case, the common populace is itself upset about what Christianity has meant to their way of life in this city. And then, just in case we weren't sure that there was legitimate opposition to Christianity, how about supernatural powers at work? Now, in this case, you have a story where the supernatural power is as favorable as they're likely to be. The woman with the spirit is walking around saying, "This is the servant of the Most High," and they're preaching the gospel. As spirits go, this is a least troubling one. But even in that, it was an obstacle, and it just highlights the fact that everywhere Paul and the apostles went, they found supernatural influences at work when they got there. Casting out demons and healing diseases, things of this nature, is commonplace in the book of Acts and in the Gospels. We kind of take that for granted, that if the worst of our problems would be human governments. And Paul understands that actually when he went to a place, the spirits of the realm of darkness were also arrayed against him. And he had to contend with that. And so before we kind of make this naive statement, well, you know, things used to be easier. People were ready to hear the gospel in the book of Acts, and boy, that's the reason Christianity spread and grew. No, that was in the face of fierce opposition. Everything existing in that culture was arrayed against Christianity. Well, that hurts, because it was easier for me as a Christian to say, we're failing today because things were harder now than they were back then. But if that's not the case, if they had just as fierce opposition, maybe more, then what is it that we're not getting right? And why isn't Christianity, at least apparently, having the kind of success we'd like to see from the book of Acts? Let me suggest to you then that there is one feature of Christianity on display in this story over and over again that we do need to recapture. It comes across in many different ways, and the word itself is not even in the text. I'm going to supply it for you. It's the word genuineness, or maybe authenticity. When people encountered Christianity, they found something that was not a fraud. They found something that was not a hoax. And you can't pay for that. I mean, that's you can't buy that kind of publicity of genuine, authentic faith at work in people's lives, and you see it all throughout the story that follows. So the first 8 or so verses we've read, all bad news, right? Opposition of every sort, worldly and otherworldly, everything's against Christianity. But listen to how Christianity responds and thrives, beginning in verse 25. First of all, Christianity thrived because of the genuine faith of disciples. Verse 25, about midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. Genuine faith takes place when you think nobody's listening, by the way. Genuine morality takes place when no one's there to catch you. Genuine joy happens in prison cells. These people had a genuine devotion to God. They aren't putting on a show for anybody. None of the powerful people that they might be trying to influence are listening. The only people that can hear them are other prisoners who have no say in what happens next anyway. This isn't a show. This is people with genuine faith. They are legitimately worshiping God in a dungeon. In the worst possible scenario, which Paul finds himself in quite a lot, by the way, they break out into songs. Take a tour sometime of your local correctional facility, or just ask Bill Hamrick, how much singing goes on in prison cells. Prisoners have a tendency to say some things to their captors, but usually not described as songs, hymns, and spiritual songs, right? Prison is a rowdy place. Dungeons is a depressing place. You have some things you might want to say to your captors. Most of them can't be repeated in pulpits. But how is it that Paul and his fellows respond? It's with genuine worship. They believe their God and their gospel has not been defeated even here. And it's because of that genuine faith that they have genuine joy and genuine worship. And they do it even when nobody's watching. That is a signifier of the kind of people they are. I don't know if anybody is converted because Paul is singing in a prison cell. But I will say a lot of people are converted because Paul is the kind of person who sings in a prison cell. Because of the genuine faith that is in every feature of his life, whether you're looking or not, he is able to interact with people in a different way than any charlatan ever could. In verse 26, Christianity thrived because of genuine works of God. I've tried to emphasize this throughout the book of Acts in our series. If I haven't done it enough, listen here. Christianity works because of God. If a bunch of humans, 12 fellows in Palestine, say, hey, let's start a religion, that will be fun, this doesn't work. By the way, important note for Christians today, if a group of Christians in Glenpool, Oklahoma, say, hey, let's have a successful church and grow it, that won't work either. Humans don't grow churches. Humans don't convert lost people. God's works makes those things happen. Either God is at work in it and we can participate in that or not, but it will always be the work of God. As Paul himself says, I watered and Apollos planted and all that, but listen, God gives the increase and he always has. So in verse 26, and suddenly there was a great earthquake so that the foundations of the prison were shaken and immediately all the doors were open and everyone's bonds were unfastened. You know why those doors opened up and the bonds were unfastened? Because God wanted them to be. Because God was at work and he wanted something to happen next, and so it did. And there wasn't a lock you could put on that prison cell that would keep it closed if God decided it was going to be open. God was at work in that city and something was going to happen. And you make that list we made a moment ago, mobs of people, government, supernatural powers, everything in opposition to Christianity. None of that stands a chance against the Lord our God once he decides to act. He can tremble the very foundations of the prison itself, and he can cause to shake the foundations of a society, and he often does. We wait for that day. We look for that. We hope for that. And we have faith in the genuine works of God when they happen. God is at work in American culture. I don't always know how. I'd like to know. I would like answers. I would like a printout of everything that will happen in the next 10 years and how Christians can participate in that and do good things. He doesn't send that to me, it turns out. But what we do have is faith that there are genuine works of God at work. That he has not abandoned his people, that the Christ who said, lo, I am with you always, still is. And that we look for him to be at work, and we look for ways to participate in those genuine works of God. In verse 27 through 28, Christianity thrived because of the genuine kindness of Christians. When the jailer woke and saw the prison doors were open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself, supposing that the prisoners had escaped. But Paul cried with a loud voice, do not harm yourself, for we are all here. Where was the kindness in that, by the way? It's subtle, but you can catch it. The jailer is in an honor-bound situation where he has failed in his responsibility, and the only honorable thing left to him in his time and place and culture is in despair to take his own life, because if he doesn't, somebody's going to. He's got one job, and he hasn't done it. In his mind, everybody's free. I don't know how a jailer at this moment in history treats his prisoners. But I'm just guessing there wasn't a high premium on civil rights. I don't know of any reason to assume that this jailer was a particularly nice fellow who had treated Paul and his friends very well. I don't know if he did or didn't. What I do know is he is the person on the outside with the keys. And Paul and Silas have every reason to see him as the enemy. They don't have to do anything. Think of this from an ethical point of view. Paul isn't stabbing the guy with a sword. All he has to do is nothing. And this mean, hateful man, perhaps, just goes away. There's a little bit of justice to it even, isn't there? Some irony, some poetic irony of that the man who held you captive kills himself unnecessarily while you sit in your cell. He doesn't have to do anything. Paul doesn't have to do or say anything. He could just let this man do what he's going to do and move on. And yet Paul interjects into that situation. Not only does he not run away, which would have been a perfectly reasonable thing to do, but he speaks up and says, hey, don't do that. Don't do yourself any harm. We're actually all still here. That's a simple act. And in fact, in this story, it's probably the smallest thing that takes place. Just one simple comment, hey, we're still here. But you understand that that was an act of kindness, and it was genuine. Paul doesn't get anything out of that. He's not guaranteed freedom because of that. He's not benefited because his jailer lives longer. Christians are tempted to see the world in terms of us Christians and them bad folks, good guys and bad guys. Paul doesn't see the world that way. He sees people in need of help and people who can do the helping. He sees someone who needs some kindness, and he shows him kindness whether this man ever had showed him kindness before or not. It's genuine. That's what kindness is, by the way. I could preach a long sermon, I promised I wouldn't, but I could preach a long sermon on just the topic of kindness, is that kindness is not something you do when you think you get something out of it. Kindness is what you do when you get nothing out of it. That's genuine kindness, and that's what Christians need to be doing. Christians don't help other people because we think it will help our church grow or because it will do something in the long run good for the congregation. We help other people because we help other people. We're kind because we're kind, because that's the way that Christians behave. And that genuine kindness makes a difference in the world. And verses 29 through 32, Christianity thrived because of the genuine gospel of Jesus. And the jailer called for lights and rushed in, and trembling with fear, he fell down before Paul and Silas. Then he brought them out and said, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" And they said, "Believe in the Lord Jesus, and you will be saved, you and your household." And they spoke the word of the Lord to him and to all who were in his house. They saw this as an opportunity to say what needs to be said. Think of some other things they could have said. This would be a great opportunity to say, "Oh, by the way, we were innocent," to plead your case, to say, "We told you so, leave us alone." This would be a great opportunity to rant against the Roman Empire or any other number of political things they could have said or done. And ultimately, that's not what they do. You give a disciple of Christ an opportunity to speak, and they've got something to say. It is the word of the Lord. It is the gospel of Jesus Christ and the call to believe in that gospel. And that's what they're going to say every time. I suspect, had you been in the prison cell, that's what Paul was telling the guy before they were let loose. Paul has a good habit of preaching to his captors. And I suspect it's exactly what he kept on preaching afterward. That every opportunity was an opportunity to preach the genuine gospel of Jesus Christ and all that it entailed. And that meant saving your captors. This would be a great moment for a sermon about hellfire and brimstone. You're right, you are lost, and you're going to burn. You're a terrible person. You weren't very nice to us. Instead, they talk about the good news of Jesus Christ and how he died to save even you. The genuine gospel of Jesus Christ is what thrives in Christianity. In verses 33 through 34, Christianity thrived because of the genuine conversion of sinners. In verse 33 and following, "And he took them the same hour of the night and washed their wounds, and he was baptized at once, he and all his family. And he brought them up into his house and set food before them, and he rejoiced along with his entire household that he had believed in God." Christian conversion is not a switch in party affiliation. It is not a change in some element of your life disconnected from all the rest. Christianity is a complete change of behavior. A man who was about to kill himself in despair is now singing with joy. The jailer is now singing like the captives were just a few verses earlier. It's a complete change of life. The man who was intent to lock them away is now providing them a place in his own home. The man who provided the wounds is now healing the wounds. This is an absolute conversion. He has changed and been changed by the gospel of Jesus Christ, and he's different now, and all the world is going to see it. That's the kind of thing we're looking for in Christianity. We're not looking for people to make a nod in the direction of, I suppose Jesus is all right, but actually to change their life and vocation, their manner, their speech, their thinking, their heart, everything top to bottom, in accordance with the genuine gospel of Jesus Christ. That's the conversion we see. And when that happens, it snowballs. It starts with the jailer. It spreads to his household. It spreads to an entire community. The world is changed when people genuinely convert to Jesus Christ. And finally, I'd comment that Christianity thrived because of the genuine courage of the church. This is what we would call a near miss, right? Paul and Silas were in trouble. How could this story have ended otherwise? It would have been a short story, but it could have ended with, and they executed them that morning, right? It could have been a really short story. It's what we would call a near miss. What do you do after a near miss? If you're like me and you evade lethal danger by the skin of your teeth and you just barely get by, your first thought is not to rush back into the lion's mouth, right? You think, wow, we kind of got lucky there. Maybe we need to dodge this a little bit. Maybe we need to lie low. We even have that. We're going to lie low just a little bit. We're not saying be cowardly. Just stay out of the limelight just for a little bit, because that was really close. That could have been bad. Not the attitude of the church. In verse 35, but when it was day, the magistrate sent to the police, saying, let these men go. And the jailer reported these words to Paul, saying, the magistrates have sent to let you go. Therefore, come out now and go in peace. Paul said to them, they have beaten us publicly, uncondemned men who are Roman citizens, and have thrown us into prison. And do they now throw us out secretly? No. Let them come themselves and take us out. The police reported these words to the magistrates, and they were afraid when they heard that they were Roman citizens. So they came and apologized to them, and they took them out and asked them to leave the city. So they went out to the prison and visited Lydia. And when they had seen the brothers, they encouraged them and departed. Don't miss the beauty of that last section of the story, because the powers that be realize something weird happened last night, and we don't want any part of it. And so tell you what, fellas, we're going to call it even. You just go. We don't say anything. You don't say anything. Everybody walks away, and everybody lives. That's got to be good news, right? Nobody gets executed. Nobody's in prison. Everybody goes their way. Paul says, nope. That's not the way we're going to do it. We came in through the front door. We're going back out through the front door. Something was done here that people need to talk about. There's a legal issue involved. He's a Roman citizen, and there is some legality to go with it. But that, to me, is not even the most important part of the story. It's that Paul is intentionally picking a fight with someone who nearly did away with him the day before. This was a near miss, and Paul says, actually, I'd like to make a point about what happened. I'd like to create a little spectacle. And then don't miss the end of it, because they say, okay, fine, fine, fine. We're all concerned. We don't want any more trouble. Just leave town. Don't miss that. They do leave town slowly. It doesn't say, and then they left town. It says, and they went down, and they visited Lydia. And, you know, they hung around a little bit and encouraged all the brethren. They told the church what had taken place, and they take their time. They're leaving, but they're not being chased out of town. It's entirely possible the magistrates get fed up and go arrest them again. Don't they know how this could end the next day? The church, fully faithful, fully convinced of the goodness of God, has genuine courage and boldness to kindly, politely demand that the gospel be heard. To politely and kindly live as a faithful church in a dark and unfaithful world. And they are determined to do it. So when you ask me, how is it that the church succeeds? I don't think it's by gimmickry. I don't think there was any magic program that they had that we're missing. I don't think the circumstances were somehow easier for them than they are for us. It's the genuineness of Christian faith, the genuineness of God's work, the genuineness of the gospel, the authenticity of the church and all that it was doing in its courage that led to the growth of the church, and that is precisely the light this world needs today in our community and every other. If you are compelled by the gospel of Christ to be converted in genuine conversion to that genuine life, and authenticity to respond to what God is doing and to be part of it, we would encourage you to be part of this group of believers who's intending to do that right here. We're going to stand and sing a word of encouragement. If there's anything we can do to help you do that, won't you come?